Dr. Ward is going to inform us as to some of the problems that can occur with respect to water treatment for extracorporeal therapies.
Well, thank you very much, and I shall try and follow these three very elegant presentations that we've had so far with something which is, I'm afraid, far more practical, and I'm sure to your great regret, I don't believe I have a single equation to show you. What I am going to talk about is the role of water quality and the importance of water quality in hemodialysis, and I'm going to try to cover these four areas for you. The first, very briefly, to try and explain to you why hemodialysis patients are really at risk from any contaminants that are in the water we use to treat them, what adverse outcomes may be associated with those contaminants, what are the key contaminants, and I guess the thing that's probably of most interest to all of you in the long run is how can you assure that levels of those contaminants will be at a safe value in the water we use to treat our patients. And in a minute here, I will, there we go. So, very simply, why hemodialysis patients are at greater risk to waterborne contaminants than are people with normal renal function can easily be summarized in this cartoon. On the left-hand side, you see a normal person with normal renal function who ingests, on average, 14 liters of water a week in all forms. Their exposure to that water is across an active transport barrier, the GI tract, which is able to control to a large extent what may or may not be absorbed from that water. And finally, anything that does make it from the water across the GI tract into the body has a means for eliminating any of those substances that may be undesirable through form of urinary excretion. Contrast the dialysis patient, who is exposed to somewhere between 300 or closer to 400 liters of water a week in the form of dialysate. The exposure takes place across a non-selective membrane, at least in terms of most of the things that we will be concerned about as contaminants in water. They're relatively small and will cross that membrane very easily. Worse than that, actually, many of them, once they do cross the membrane, bind to passing carrier proteins, so that the concentration gradient is always maintained at the at maximum value. And clearly, of course, there's no renal excretion. Just to express this in kind of another way, a dialysis patient will see in about 2 years what someone with normal renal function will see in terms of water exposure in their lifetime. So this is a really accelerated exposure to water and anything bad that might be in it. And there are a number of substances commonly found in water that indeed are toxic to dialysis patients. And this slide is a reasonably complete, but probably not totally complete list. And it includes metal ions, substances that are put in the water for disinfection purposes, various bacterial products, things that may be in the water because of agricultural practices, and so on. They come from a variety of places. Perversely enough, quite a few of the things that are toxic to hemodialysis patients are actually deliberately placed in the water by the municipality. And they're placed there because, in balance, they offer some advantage to the total population. So, for example, many municipalities use chloramines to disinfect the water supply so that when you turn your tap on and take a glass of water, you don't get a big load of bacteria. But these substances, as we'll see in a few minutes, are strong oxidizing agents and oxidize red cells and cause a hemolytic anemia. Fluoride put in the water because it's effective in preventing dental caries. Aluminum is added to the water as a clarifying agent in the form of alum. So many of these things are deliberately added to the water. Some things just arise from the nature of where water is obtained. If you live in an agricultural area, there are fertilizers that may have high amounts of nitrate in the water. If you live in an area that has a limestone-based geology, you're likely to have hard water with a lot of calcium and magnesium. Some things are added in the dialysis unit, even though you may not appreciate that you're adding them. In the old days, before we knew better, we used a lot of metal pipes, copper and zinc. They contribute copper and zinc to the water and cause adverse effects to the patients. And as we'll see towards the end of the talk this morning, endotoxins from bacterial proliferation, once you take the bacteriostatic agent of chloramine or chlorine out, bacteria can thrive and produce endotoxin, which will produce a variety of adverse effects in our patients. And just to give you an example of the sorts of impact these substances can have on these on our patients, take the example of anemia, or as we, I guess these days, tend more often to see this problem as an apparent erythropoietin resistance. There are a number of substances found in water supplies that will cause these adverse events, including chloramines, I think probably the most common one. They oxidize hemoglobin to methemoglobin, and then also inhibit antioxidant pathways, so you get oxidative destruction of red cells. Copper does something similar. Mechanism of zinc is unknown. And aluminum, which decreases hemoglobin synthesis and also plays around with iron metabolism. You see in the case of chloramines what happens. There's oxidation of hemoglobin to methemoglobin, which condenses to form these Heinz bodies. These are now defunct red cells, which are cleaned out of the circulation by the spleen. Just an idea of the impact that can have on red cell survival. We see here these very early data from Minneapolis in the early 1970s, where this effect was first described, that if you treated patients against dialysate that was produced with tap water, which contained at that time in Minneapolis about 3 milligrams per liter of chloramines. That's a very typical value that is commonly used, somewhere 3 to 4 milligram range, is a very common level in municipal water disinfection. So these data, I think, are as relevant today as they were 30 years ago. You see that red cell half-life is about 10 days. And the same patients were treated against purified water, which was purified in those days by distillation. You see red cell survival increased to 30 days. So there was roughly a threefold effect on red cell survival by the inclusion of chloramines in the water used to form the dialysate. It is a lesson that we have learned and learned again and continue to learn. This is a partial list of, and I've stopped adding to it now because I can't fit anything more on the slide, and reports continue to come out of instances of episodes of chloramine-induced hemolysis in dialysis patients, sometimes affecting quite large numbers of patients. All over from the original observations in Minneapolis, seen in California, in Philadelphia, seen it in Europe, seen it in Asia, in Australia. I mean, this just continues. We continue not to be somehow aware of this problem. That's, I think, in sometimes because of why it arises. And if you look over here at what the cause of these outbreaks were, they were related to a number of things. Many of them were related to changes in municipal water treatment practices, where the municipality, for whatever reason, would switch from using, typically from using chlorine to disinfect the water. Chlorine is really a relatively minor problem compared with chloramines. They'd switch to using chloramines and either not tell anybody they were going to do it or tell people and have them not hear the message, which is what happened in California with this little group of outbreaks here. I guess it was the Los Angeles or Southern California Water Board went from using chlorine to using chloramines. It was widely publicized and widely ignored. And in fact, they had to stop doing it for a little while the dialysis units caught up. So I take home message from this, I guess, is that you should pay some attention to what your local water treatment company is doing, and if possible, have some sort of an ongoing dialogue with them. So as a result of our past experience, which has shown us that water can have many different contaminants harmful to our patients, back in the starting in the early 1980s and recently updated in 2001, we have now a water quality standard for the water used for our dialysis applications. And this is the 2001 edition. It includes a whole slew of substances. The most important ones, I think, are these substances over here, the ones that are particularly toxic in dialysis patients. They are generally not toxic in the general population. Aluminum, which we've chloramines, which we just talked about, copper fluoride, etc., etc. It establishes levels for these. It establishes levels for microbiological contaminants. This group of substances here, this is the Safe Drinking Water Act. These are substances, typically heavy metal ions, that are known to be toxic to the general population and for which the EPA has established maximum levels that you can expect to have in drinking water. The standard generally allows a tenfold lower concentration for dialysis patients, and that's based on this what I showed you at the start, that dialysis patients see many, many, many larger volume of water than the general population does. And then, of course, substances in the dialysate that you would not want to have at very high levels because they would mess with your prescription of your dialysate. You have to remember, when you see the sodium 70 here, this is not 70 milliequivalents per liter. This is 70 milligrams per liter, and this is, you know, just about 3 milliequivalents per liter. So it's not, you don't want to have levels of these that would markedly change the dialysate concentration. That's why they're included. But these are really the ones you have to pay real attention to. It's considered a serious enough problem that CMS, or HCFR as they used to be known, actually require in their conditions for coverage for ESRD services, which is a fancy way of saying these are the rules you have to follow if you expect to collect money from the government for providing dialysis services. They actually require, amongst other things, that you employ water quality requirements that meet the standard I showed you on the last slide. And they say it again, just in case you didn't get it the first time. Now, these conditions for coverage are allegedly, or they are certainly, undergoing revision at CMS at the moment. And they're allegedly going to come out in a revised form this year, but they've been saying that for some years now, and they still haven't appeared. And so I can't tell you if there will be any change in this. But there will have to be some change, since these particular documents no longer exist after the 2001 revision to the water quality standard. I suspect that HCFR is still going to require you to meet the standards you saw on the same, on the earlier slide, one way or the other. So how do you do that? Well, I mean, clearly you have to have some way of purifying the water. You have to have a water treatment system. Every dialysis facility has to have one. I don't care how good you think your local water is, there'll be a day when it's not good enough. So you have to have a water treatment system. It has to produce water of appropriate quality being what I showed you a couple of slides ago, and it has to be able to do it from the worst case feed water. Now, you understand that municipal water varies a little bit throughout the season on what it has in it. Some times of the year they add more aluminum because they have to work harder to clarify the water. Sometimes of the year they may add more chloramines because bacterial burdens are greater. So you have to know a little bit about what's the worst that my feed water is likely to be. And then your water treatment system has to be able to handle that worst case water. It's got to have enough capacity to meet the peak demand in your facility. In fact, it's desirable to have some excess capacity because along with a lot of things, water treatment systems, or the performance of water treatment systems in terms of how much water they produce, tends to fade a little bit with time. They wear out a little bit, like all of us. So excess capacity is good. And finally, I hope I'll convince you of this later on, it's really important to pay attention to designing a system or having a system that's designed to be easy to maintain, because difficult to maintain systems tend in the end not to be well maintained, and that only leads to problems. A water treatment system will in all likelihood consist or comprise a number of purification processes. The major ones are listed on this slide. They'll have carbon adsorption because that is essentially the only method we have available to us for removing chloramines and other organics. It'll probably have a softener to handle the calcium, and almost certainly will have reverse osmosis as the central purification process. This is probably the most effective means we have of removing a spectrum of ionic contaminants as well as providing a microbiological barrier. It may include deionization if you need additional capacity to remove ionic contaminants. We'll discuss this a little bit again in a minute. And it's likely to contain some sort of ultrafiltration processes, again, for their ability to remove microbiological contaminants. Typical water treatment system will look something like this, and it can be divided up into three basic parts. There's the so-called pretreatment cascade, the primary purification process, and then the distribution system. And I'm going to say a few words about each of these. This is not going to be a design class, so we're not going to get into sizing things and all the rest of it, but I think it's good to have some idea of what these three sections of the system do for you. For the pretreatment system, which will generally bring inlet water in, blend it to a constant temperature, and then have a series of filtration steps, serves the purpose of preparing the water for the primary purification step. And then once you've purified the water clearly, you've got to distribute it to its points of use. So pretreatment. The biggest thing a pretreatment cascade does for you is it serves to protect the primary purification process. So for example, depth filters will take out any large particles that are in the water, since these finally can foul downstream membrane-based processes. Softener to remove calcium is that you want to get the calcium out before you get to the reverse osmosis system. Reverse osmosis will remove calcium wonderfully, but the trouble is you also tend to foul the membranes with calcium carbonate deposits in the process, shorten the life of the membrane, have to replace the membrane modules, and have to have interminable fights with your facility administrator who wants to know why you're spending all that money. The softener is a very effective way of saving you those arguments. The pretreatment cascade will also have carbon in it. It is protective in that it will remove any chlorine compounds, since most RO membranes are sensitive to chlorine. So you want to get it out of there in order to protect your RO membranes again. Also, though, it is very important to know that the pretreatment, the carbon part of the pretreatment cascade, is really what protects your patients from the adverse effects of chloramines. But taken together here, what this really does is you try to establish the optimum operating conditions for the primary purification process so that you can get the best you can out of it. Now I'm going to say a couple words more about chloramines, since all of this, you know, the downside of missing all of this is spending money on RO membranes. The downside of not doing this well is that you'll hurt the patients. So carbon adsorption with some sort of granular activated carbon or so-called catalytic carbon is generally the most effective means of removing chloramines. And I always used to think that was it. That was how you remove chloramines. And unfortunately, as I grow older, I learn that it doesn't always work. And I'm learning more often that it doesn't always work. So carbon adsorption may not be effective under circumstances that I describe here as rare, but I'm not sure they're not becoming more common. First of all, carbon will not remove so-called N-chloramines or naturally occurring chloramines. These are, in other words, chloraminated organic compounds in the water that are just not simple monochloramine. These are normally polar molecules that are very poorly removed by carbon. So in seasons or parts of the country where there are a lot of these, carbon will not work or will not work very well. Carbon will absolutely not work if the municipality is adding orthophosphate to the water in order to comply with the lead and copper rule. Now you don't need to know what the lead and copper rule is. What you do need to know is that this orthophosphate does a very good job of masking the carbon. And if you have this in the water, carbon will not work for the removal of chloramines. And carbon will not work very well if the municipal water has a high pH. And increasing pH has been another way that municipalities have addressed this lead and copper rule. So it's not uncommon now to find municipal water supplies that have pH of greater than 9. And I've heard or seen them greater than 10. That's pretty alkaline water. Carbon doesn't work very well under those conditions. If you're unfortunate enough to be in one of these circumstances, you're probably going to have to do something else to remove the chloramines. There are a limited number of choices. Some of them work in some cases, but not in others. The one that I have seen work fairly well for all of these things is to actually inject metabisulfite into the water in the pretreatment section of the cascade. The metabisulfite reacts to the chloramines. The daughter products are all well rejected by RO. You should only do this with great caution. You have to have a well-designed, safeguarded, monitored metering system, because the downside of having a metering system go haywire and put something bad in the water is bad things can happen. But it's sometimes, under special circumstances, really the only choice you have. If you're going to use carbon, which fortunately is what most of us are going to be able to do, there are certain rules to follow. Use two adsorption beds in series with this total of the so-called empty bed contact time of 10 minutes. Empty bed contact time is just a measure of the residence time of the water in the resin bed. And you have to have enough residence time for the chloramines to diffuse up to the surface into the pores of the carbon and get adsorbed. So you need residence time. You need to make sure you use a carbon that has capacity for removing chloramines. And typically that means using a granular activated carbon with a so-called iodine number of greater than 900. Or you can use these catalytic carbons. You have to monitor the performance of the beds regularly, at least daily. In some states it's required that you, at each patient shift, and I think if you really want to feel safe about it, you have a continuous monitor. Because the downside of an exhausting carbon bed is chloramines making it to the patients and leading to red cell destruction. It's important to note, you cannot regenerate carbon beds by backwashing them. And what all the backwashing will do is kind of fluff the bed up and get rid of any channeling in it, but it does not restore binding sites. And so once a carbon bed is exhausted, it has to be replaced. In order to have that happen in a controlled manner and not emergently, you install the two beds in series, you monitor here. When you finally see some chloramine starting to appear for the very first time at the sampling port, you know this bed is gone, but you've got all of this bed capacity left, which allows you to continue running until the end of the day or the weekend or whenever it is, in which case you can take this now partially exhausted second bed, put it in the first position, put a brand new virgin carbon bed in here, and throw that one away, or have someone carry it away and throw it away. And this is the preferred configuration, which creates the least problem for you. Now, the primary purification process. It really comes down to a choice between two things. You can use reverse osmosis, or you can use ion exchange. And they have their pluses and their minuses. My bias is that reverse osmosis always outweighs ion exchange. So I'll be upfront about that. There are people that may disagree with me. Reverse osmosis removes a wide range of both ionic and non-ionic contaminants, although it does not remove chloramines. It provides a barrier against microbiological contaminants. We've talked about pretreatment. It has some capital costs, but the operating costs are low. The two keys here, I think, are ionic and non-ionic, and microbiological barrier. Ion exchange is effective against ionic contaminants, but does not remove non-ionic contaminants. Clearly, it's ion exchange. If you're not an ion, you're not going to be exchanged. It may also have some limits for aluminum removal, as we'll see in a minute. They have finite capacity. Rather than being a barrier against bacteria, they tend to be a place, lots of surface area, lots of nutrients, where bacteria proliferate, and they in fact cause more problems in that point of view than they solve for you. There's a risk of acute fluoride toxicity, which is not to be underrated. We'll look at that a little bit in a minute. They do have low capital costs, but the operating costs are high. So I think that this, generally for me, this is not really a discussion. This is what you need. And my view of it is, if you can't get water of sufficient quality with a single-stage reverse osmosis unit, then you use a two-stage reverse osmosis unit. Basically, you have one reverse osmosis unit, you take the purified water from that and feed it to a second one. That'll give you very high quality water and give you a very
good microbiological barrier. Now, aluminum is highly toxic to our patients and is a very interesting substance. It's a so-called amphoteric substance, which goes from having a cationic form to an anionic form depending on the pH, and passes through being colloidal aluminum on the way. It passes through being a colloidal aluminum at about neutral pH. Now, if you're relying on ion exchange to remove aluminum, colloidal aluminum is not going to be removed. No charge, no exchange. And so if your pH happens to get down into this range, ion exchange will be relatively ineffective at removing aluminum. This lesson was learnt the hard way in Yorkshire and England in the, I guess in the late 1970s, where they thought they had a nice system for removing the aluminum from the water, and wondered why their patients were still getting dementia and aluminum bone disease. Well, it's this phenomenon here. The other thing to remember about ion exchange is that that's what it is. It's exchanging ions. And there's a resin bead with iron binding sites on it. They come loaded with, say, hydrogen ions and hydroxyl ions, which are weakly bound, and then get progressively replaced by more strongly bound cations and anions. Now, that's okay. So for a long time, you get ions from the water replacing hydrogen ions and hydroxyl ions, which get together and make water. But when the hydroxyl ions and hydrogen ions are gone, the next weakest bound ion is replaced by more strongly bound ions. And it turns out that on the anion side, what comes off after the hydroxyl ions are gone is fluoride. Now I'm going to have to go. And that can cause you a real problem, because if you look at this left-hand panel here and you look at the fluoride concentration in the effluent from the deionizer versus the water throughput, and here's the tap water being fed to it. And so for a long time, fluoride's being taken up, hydroxyl ions are being given off. All the hydroxyl ions are gone, and then sulfate, for example, starts to replace fluoride. And you get this huge spike of fluoride coming off, many, many times greater than what's in the tap water. This is highly toxic. Concentrations like this cause patients to die acutely. And you just see it over here in terms of resistivity. So in order to protect against this, it is absolutely required that the effluent stream from all deionizers be continuously monitored for resistivity. And that if the resistivity falls below, actually we use a value of 10 to the 6, at which point you'll see there's no fluoride, that if it falls below that, then the alarms have to go off and the water has to be shunted away from patient care. So this is another kind of potential downside of using deionizers, is that if you're not very careful, really bad things can happen if they exhaust. So a result of this is most people will end up with a water system that looks something like this. Some depth filtration, carbon softener, pretreatment cascade, reverse osmosis, and then a distribution system. And so we can buy that. We all buy it. We all have it. It works when we get it. And then, you know, then bad things can sometimes happen that are unrelated to the system we've bought, and they happen because we don't look after it, and they happen because of that other contaminant, which is microbiological. Now, here's just a brief case here of 18 pyrogenic reactions occurring. You know, this is one every 10 dialysis treatments associated with dialyzer reuse, no positive blood cultures. These are almost certainly pyrogen. Here you see it graphically. Suddenly a big spike in pyrogenic reactions went away when the people stopped reusing. So what was going on here? Well, here was their water treatment system. They had the pretreatment, they had an RO, and they had a storage tank. They thought they needed to have really nice, ionically pure water before they went to the patient, so they had a deionizer after the storage tank with a UV light after the deionizer to kill the bacteria. And then they took the water off here to their reuse system, and this was a dead-end system here. So basically, what was wrong with that system? Well, first of all, they had a storage tank, which always tends to be a place where bacteria get together, and they had a deionizer, which I told you earlier is an excellent breeding ground for bacteria. Then they had a UV light that kills the bacteria. When you kill bacteria, you make endotoxin. So lots of endotoxin. They were rinsing their dialysis with tap water through a hose that could be easily contaminated because it lay in the bottom of the sink. And they weren't doing any routine microbiological testing, and they disinfected their system once a year, whether it needed it or not. So they were set up for bad things to happen. It's common enough that when you have outbreaks of septicemia and pyrogenic reactions in dialysis units, the important thing to notice from the CDC's experience is that's always associated with poor quality water. How could they have avoided this problem? Well, they could have had a water treatment system with a microbiological barrier at the end. They could have distributed their water through a loop. They should have been monitoring it and disinfecting it, and they maybe should have been paying attention to their patients. And I'm speeding up because the orange light came on. Tom Deppner told us he had seen the enemy. Well, I have also seen the enemy, and this is the enemy. This is bacterial biofilm, where you see a surface of a tube here, you see organisms, and you see themselves busily secreting this glycocalyx material, which after a little while will completely shield them from the bulk water flow and from any germicides that you may be using to try and kill the organisms. If you allow this material to get established in your water distribution system, you are condemning yourself to a life of frustration and your technicians to weekends of being in on the dialysis unit on Sundays trying to disinfect the water system. Just a measure of how big a problem it can be, here from some tubing from dialysis machines where the water flowing through the tube had pretty low bacterial burdens, that when they scraped the wall of the tubing, here's how many organisms they found. This is 10 to the 5 for those of you who can't read in the back. So this is 10 to the 1 units in the water, 10 to the 5 units living on the wall. So you can purify, you can disinfect the water system all you like, but it just gets recolonized from the biofilm. So you need to design your system, make sure your system is designed and operated to try and prevent that from happening. Using a distribution loop, avoiding stagnant flow. If you use a storage tank, as small as, only as large as you need, tightly sealed, able to drain from the lowest points and with adequate disinfection mechanisms. Use bacterial control devices such as ultrafilters. But here's one message to take away from this morning's presentation for those of you who are going to end up being medical directors of dialysis units. If you forget all the rest, take this one away. Disinfection schedules have to be designed to prevent contamination with bacteria, not to eliminate it after it's happened, because you'll never eliminate it. You'll get rid of all the planktonic bacteria, but the adherent bacteria behind the biofilm, you will never get rid of them until you replace your piping system. So prevention is the real key here to an easy life, or at least it's the what will protect you from having a very hard life. And you need to monitor the water system carefully. I just repeat the water quality standards here again. But a couple of things about monitoring, because it is important. The standard technique is to use spread plate cultures. Now, most of you will send your water samples probably to a laboratory that specializes in this, and they'll use spread plate cultures or they'll use membrane filtration. But if you are doing it yourself or if your hospital lab is doing it, there are two things to, I think, avoid. Absolutely, you cannot plate the samples using a calibrated loop, which is the standard technique used for body fluids. It puts too small a volume on the plate to have the required sensitivity for the assay, and it's specifically prohibited. Then there are always these sample paddle things, which are very convenient, but can give either false positive or false negative results if they're not used very carefully. So my view of these is not to use them. Membrane filtration is clearly the technique to use. But just if you start to get lab results back that always say no growth, and you're getting your stuff done in the hospital lab, it's worthwhile to walk down to the lab and ask the person who's doing the cultures how they're doing it. Make sure they're not doing this, or maybe this. Trend analysis of data is very good, because you can often then see things happening before they happen. So I'll finish here by trying to just summarize the main points. Remind you that dialysis patients are highly sensitive to contaminants that are commonly found in our water supplies. They cause a variety of problems, including anemia, bone disease, nausea, vomiting, things that we unfortunately all too often see. If you start to see these things, sometimes you should think, maybe there's something wrong with the water. No water supply is suitable for dialysis without some further purification. And avoiding complications as time goes by really requires constant attention to water quality, particularly with regard to the microbiology. I'll finish there and take questions.
We have time for some questions.
While we're waiting, Dr. Ward, do you want to comment on U.S. versus European standards for microbiology in terms of water supply in dialysis?
I will comment on it since you asked me to. Actually, this is an issue that is starting to be talked about finally here. Now, I will briefly, tell you why John's comment, perhaps, is that it is now widely considered in Europe and other parts of the world that that low-level microbiological contaminant of the water used to form the dialysate is an important factor in the chronic inflammatory state associated with hemodialysis. And that as a result, there's a move, at least now that the Europeans now recommend this in their best practice guidelines, that the microbiological quality of the water used for dialysis, for dialysate, be of a much higher level than we presently require here. There's, growing clinical evidence that the effect is real. It's a hot topic here at the moment. We are currently discussing what to do with our microbiological standards for dialysate. And like all of these discussions, it's the bell-shaped curve of people. There are those people, and I guess I'm one of them, who would like to see us move forward towards the European position. There are those people at the other end, largely the people who are going to have to spend the money perhaps to do it, who are resisting the change, and there's the big mass of people in the middle who don't quite know what to do yet, but will be inevitably moved one way or the other. For me, the answer is clear. We should really be trying to move towards European quality. Here, I think it is mostly, we really need to push down the endotoxin concentration. And we have the technology to do it. It's mostly a matter of taking good care of what we already have and perhaps using point-of-use ultrafilters in our machines. And as you will all, most of you will know, all the new machines now are coming with that capability. And it seems to me to be a disservice to our patients not to use that capability.
One question related to that before we move on. If, especially in Tom, one of Tom's conclusions was, we're doing fine with small solute, then we have accumulation of some things, and then perhaps toxicity from the dialysis. Lee says maybe we should do dialysis more often. How important do you think this endotoxin business and ultra-pure dialysate is going to be if we're going to be exposing the patients to it daily?
Well, even more important, I would think. I think that's a good point, that if we're doing more frequent dialysis and exposing our patients to larger volumes, we probably do need to think much harder about improving the quality of the dialysate. It's really another, it's another session, in effect, the story, but I think it's really what we all should be trying to do.
You properly emphasize the risk of contamination, bacterial contamination from the ionizer. But virtually all of your systems that you showed had a water softener in the circuit, which is also an ion exchange device. What protects that from contamination as opposed to the other?
Nothing. Actually, the short word is nothing. But remember, it's before the reverse osmosis system. And the other thing, so you've always got a barrier after it. The other thing I would say about softeners is that once a day or once every other day, depending on how you're set up, you're regenerating your softener with very high concentration brine solutions, which will kill any organisms growing in them pretty effectively. It may generate a lot of endotoxin, but you do at least have a barrier downstream of it. And you do, in fact, if you like to think of it that way, disinfect it every couple of days. But otherwise, no, they grow bacteria.
Questions?
Many systems have a deionizer online after the RO unit, as one of them demonstrated by your slide. Are you really suggesting that we should get rid of the deionizers entirely?
Yes, unless there's a compelling case to have it. And I suppose there are rare occasions when there's a compelling case to have it. Some people have it as a backup. They think, well, if my RO fails, then I can rely on the DI.
Right.
I think there's a couple of dangers to that. First of all, they tend to leave those DI tanks sitting around, sometimes for months on end, with no flow through them and nothing else happening except growth of bacteria. I think that if you really want to use DI as a backup, two things. First of all, you have to make sure you have an ultrafiltration system that follows it. And secondly, you're probably better off to try to make an arrangement with a local supplier to bring you the DI on demand so that you get freshly bedded tanks and not ones that have sat around. If you think you need the DI in order on a day-by-day basis to meet the water quality requirements, I mean, my bias is that you should strongly consider a two-stage RO system, which will clearly give you, you know, you remove 98% of 98% in the two stages on a contaminants, which is very good. Plus, you have an even better bacteriological barrier. So I think you should ask yourself the question, you know, do I really need this DI, and how quickly can I get rid of it?
And it's expensive.
Yeah, that as well.
Hi, Nick. Congratulations for your excellent exposition. As you said before, the European best practice guidelines introduced some rules about using the storage tanks on the water treatment. So they say that it should be avoided because the biofilm. We try to do now the new system with ultra pure water. I would like to ask you if, in accordance with your exposition, how important is to use ultra-pure water treatment under dialysis units?
I think I tried to answer that, you know, as I think it's very important. But let me say, I think it's worth emphasizing that it's not so much ultra-pure water that's important. It's ultra-pure dialysate that's important. I mean, leave aside the issue of reuse for a minute. That in terms of just the dialysis treatments, actually what's finally important is the quality of the final dialysate. So you can make ultra pure water. If you put it in a poorly maintained dialysis machine, you'll end up with poor quality dialysate and not protect the patients. So I think you have to focus on what the patient finally sees, which is the dialysate. Now, come back to reuse, which most of us probably are still doing here, there I think it's a slightly different calculation, because in reuse is the only circumstance where we knowingly and deliberately take the water and put it in the blood compartment in large volumes. So that if you've got water that has a lot of endotoxin in it, or even a modest amount of endotoxin, you put it in the blood compartment. I mean, I think there's clear evidence that it can bind to adsorb proteins and other structures inside the blood compartment competitively. It'll stay there until a better binder comes along, which tends to be some carrier protein next time you do dialysis, and so the patient gets an event load of endotoxin. So, I mean, I think that even if you can't find it in your heart to do ultra-pure dialysate for routine treatments, you should give serious consideration to at least trying to have the highest quality water you can for reuse. And for me, that means at least if your machines won't allow you to have point-of-use ultrafilters for your dialysate, at least you should consider installing ultrafilters at the inlet to your reuse machines so that you have the highest microbiological quality of the water that you're deliberately putting in the blood compartment.
We have time for one more question, and then perhaps the other question is going to come up to Dr. Ward.
Okay. Dr. Ward, several of my patients want to do home hemodialysis with the new personal hemodialysis system. Are there any unique water treatment requirements for that particular system to make it safe?
I don't. My familiarity with this machine is, it's been a little while since I looked at it. But actually, my understanding of it, as I recall, is that it actually has some fairly stringent water purification features, if you like, built into it. Because I think, if, as you recall, that machine actually produces its own priming solution and other fluids for use during the procedure. And there, clearly, you have to meet a very high microbiological purity. And so I think, in fact, that has a lot of those features built and designed into it already. I would think the thing, you know, in terms of do you have a trouble-free existence or a hassle-loaded existence is, again, kind of taking care that you have pre-treatment-type systems to try and present the machine with water that is optimum for its built-in purification processes.
Thank you.
Thanks again very much, Dr. Ward.